We do sound karate right.
Sucker on. Let me see. Okay, this is Paul Rodell one more time. I think this is interview 72 for me. And it is now October the 6th. I hope it's the 6th.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's Sunday the 6th. And I'm sitting here this afternoon in the office of Donald R. Sumner, the University of Georgia Agriculture Extension Station.
Experiment Station.
Experiment Station in Tifton, Georgia. Don, is that what you prefer? Or
yes,
Donald? Okay. Don was in Vietnam 1959 through 1961. We'll go through his volunteer experience. He was in agriculture, and he was one of that group of people that Gordon Brockmuller had such praise for. He said that his group, you know, you were in the experiment station set up at that time.
Yeah.
He praised you guys as a group to the skies. I mean, he really did. So, you know, I don't think I can, I'm not, you know, infringing on his privacy to say that. No, he really did. He just kind of glazed over it, like, wow, what a group. You know? and that's not any BS either. As I said before, I turned on the tape. What we've been doing is getting the background of people, starting off long before you had even thought about IVS or in any kind of position. Kind of interested in where and when you were born, what your parents were like, how you were raised, those kinds of influences on the young Donald Sumner as he goes off and becomes a human being, and rather than just an biological extension of the family. So I can just kind of shut up and let you proceed with that, and I might interject kind of to focus or to clarify, but now on it's mostly your document.
I was born September 20th, 1937, in Bow Creek Township near Studley, Hoxie, in northwest Kansas. This was at the end of the Dust Bowl, and Dad was able to get land, begin farming then, and so my background is on a farm. I went to high school. I was active in 4-H and FFA. My main interests were in farming. I went to Kansas State University from 1955 to 59 to learn more about technical agriculture. We had a drought in the mid-50s in western Kansas, not unlike the drought in the dirty 30s during the Dust Bowl.
The dirty 30s. I never heard it referred to that.
Well, this is a common term in the Midwest.
Really?
Because in addition to the Depression, the Great Plains had one of the worst droughts and was the Dust Bowl.
Yeah.
So they had a double whammy. So that's, I grew up at the end of that, not experiencing it, but I felt like I had experienced it because of the discussions of my parents.
Yeah, you could see the devastation.
Yes, and knew what they'd gone through. But anyway, Dad was able to become established in farming and did buy the, what I call the home place where he lived from 1946 until he just recently moved to town. So
your father's still alive?
Yes, my father and my stepmother are in a long-term care unit attached to the hospital.
Well, that's good that they still are.
Yes, my father is 86.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, that was my interest and why I was at Kansas State, and I got a BS degree in agricultural education because I was interested in getting a very broad background in agriculture. But in the spring of 1959, as I was finishing, I couldn't see my way clear to go back to the farm because we didn't have that large of an economic farming unit. It seemed at that time that there was a surplus in wheat, and there really wasn't that much interest that I could see in agricultural production needs in the United States. And I saw this advertisement on the bulletin board about IVS in probably February or March. So I wrote.
And you're already a senior.
And filled it out that spring when I'd be graduating in May.
Yeah.
And I got accepted then, I guess around the 1st of May, I don't remember. I remember writing, telling my parents that's what I was going to do. So I...
Well, I'm curious, though. I mean, that bulletin board, that probably was full of stuff. I mean, I can't imagine that it would be blank with only one thing there. So you had to read over all that stuff, and you chose this one. How come?
Because it struck my interest. I had considered being an agricultural missionary at one time. I was a member of the Christian Church there in Moxie, even though my parents were not active church members at that time.
You say Christian Church?
That's the Disciples of Christ.
Okay,
the Christian Church.
Okay.
It's a denomination. Yeah. But I found out in order to be an agricultural missionary in the Christian Church, you would have had to have gone to college and taken several courses in the Bible, and I really wasn't interested in being actively involved in religion. I was only interested in agricultural work, so I dropped that idea.
So
I saw the IVS announcement. Yeah. I thought, here's an opportunity to work in agriculture alone.
Yeah.
So that's
because
interested me.
Because if I can clarify just for myself now, going over as a missionary wouldn't have been, in a sense, a sectarian interest in conversions directly, but more to do good works in agriculture.
Yeah, that was what
and
my
using them as
was.
A vehicle to do so,
that's
and
right.
if it has a positive benefit for the growth of the church and the spread of the word, that will come as a result.
I found out that agricultural missionaries were expected to be also well versed in the religious aspect, but the religious aspect would have been primary and the agriculture secondary.
Oh, okay.
And my interests were the reverse.
You were the
my
reverse,
primary
yeah.
interest was agriculture.
Yeah.
So that's why.
Which is not decreasing your religious commitment or belittling it. It's just.
As you know,
I'm
sure as you know in your other interviews, several of the people in IVS had rather strong religions, strong feelings of probably along the agricultural missionary lines. And some of them probably pursued some of those interests after they left IVS.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't my area. It was primarily technical agriculture. That's what I was interested in. So that's why I applied for the position.
Yeah, and this going overseas was more attractive than trying to work in the United States as, say, maybe an extension agent or something?
Well, as I indicated, we did have wheat surpluses in the late 50s, and of course wheat is the primary crop in Kansas, and that was one of my interests. But it just didn't seem like there was a need for the knowledge in technical agriculture in the United States at that time. And I had the impression then when I read this announcement that what I had would be in demand in a developing country, although we didn't use the word developing country at that time.
Right, right.
And as you probably found out in talking with other people, I had the mistaken idea, I guess, that anything I said would be of use to the people in other countries and that they would be hanging on my every word, so to speak. So that, I felt
they
like...
did for me.
Yes, I felt like what I had would be more in demand and more useful to people in a developing country than in the United States at that time. So that was my reason for going with IVS.
I see that there's a couple reasons here. One is that you wanted to stay working in agriculture and that you were interested in the overseas work because of the need there.
Yes.
And that... Did you think that you might be redundant? In a sense, if you stayed here, because everyone was already doing the same sort of stuff?
I didn't feel the need for my knowledge here without going into graduate school. And I did that spring, I did talk to the head of the Department of Agronomy about going on for a master's degree in agronomy at Kansas State. But I was tired of school at that time. I wanted a break. I didn't want to start graduate school at that time.
Yeah, so that's kind of like another motivation.
So, and it was very fortunate for me that I had the 2-year work experience in Vietnam, because after I finished in Vietnam, I decided I wanted to go to graduate work in plant pathology.
Uh-huh.
And going through some of the things that I did in IVS, I think, gave me the tenacity to stay with graduate school the full 5.5 years it took me to get an MS and PhD,
yeah.
Because I realized what some of the alternatives were, and that this was what I wanted to do. It helped give me the determination to stick with graduate school.
Yeah, of course, real life experience does have that effect on students.
Yes.
I think both of us being in the ed biz, we know the difference between a student who's just come straight from home and one that's been out working for a while.
That's right.
But no, IVS probably was even a better than normal work experience to get a student focused in the right way for grad school.
It was a tremendous broadening experience for someone from Western Kansas who had not, been out of the Midwest to any extent. I probably hadn't traveled more than a few hundred miles from home before that.
Right. So you saw this announcement stuck up there, probably with a thumbtack or something.
Yes.
And you rode away. Did you go through any sort of interviews or with anybody, or did they do everything by mail correspondence?
At that time, everything was done by mail.
Okay.
I think they started the interview process maybe within a couple of years after that.
Yeah.
But no, I sent to IVS, and Dr. Nofsinger was in charge then.
Right.
He sent an application, I filled it out, sent it back. I think it probably had references in it. I don't remember.
Probably.
So they probably had to contact references.
Uh-huh.
One of my professors in agricultural education knew about it, because I remember talking to him that spring as I was finishing up principles of agricultural education course, and made some comment about I was going into this missionary work, and I said, well, it's not missionary work, told him what it was. So yes, someone in the department had been contacted.
Right,
he didn't have a high opinion of what I was doing. Of course, he was in the business of educating people to teach vocational agriculture in Kansas.
He didn't want you slipping away and going overseas and wasting yourself.
That was his opinion, yes.
Yeah, I was just trying to, you know, ape his opinion.
I might also say it was rather interesting. In order to fill out a humanities requirement, I took a 1-hour course in current history.
Uh-huh.
And most of that was spent in Indochina from 1945 to 1954, talking about Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. I had just studied that year or the previous year.
Uh-huh.
So I knew something about where those countries were. If I hadn't taken that course, I probably wouldn't have had any idea what Vietnam was.
Probably would have been down on the floor with a big map trying to figure out where the heck this
is. Right, yeah.
So you actually did know something about the country.
Yeah, because most of that 1 hour was spent just studying what had happened in Southeast Asia. And of course, at that time, Vietnam had been divided into South and North Vietnam.
Right. Let's see, because, by the year
that happened 59, in
54. So that's only 4 years.
So, but I finished up in, that's right. So it would have been, the book would have been written just shortly after that happened, probably.
That's right.
It was used as a textbook.
Because there was that period between the signing of the agreement and then the period when people could come down from the north to the south, et cetera, et cetera.
It was just a paperback, I think, that we actually used as a text.
Right.
It was just a short period.
Yeah, it's probably one of the number of
would have been in recent history, obviously. It just happened,
Okay. That's good, because most people just went into it really, really blind.
So what happened then? You get contacted by IBS, yes? Come with us.
I graduated from Kansas State, I think, about May the 20th. Went back to home to stay with my parents and left on a bus from Greenfield, Kansas, 17 miles from Oxy, I think about the 8th of June, and went to the Denver airport. I'd never been on a plane. I had my ticket. I knew when I was leaving. So when the time came to get on the plane, I went to the gate to get on. I hadn't checked in. Of course, they'd given my seat to someone else. And that's when I learned you had to check in to get on an airplane. So I had to wire my uncle and aunt in San Francisco and indicate that I'd missed that plane and I would be on a later one. And they put me on the next plane. They gave me a free first class seat next to a Catholic priest who was going to Hawaii. And I remember we had an interesting visit then between Denver and San Francisco. And then I visited with my uncle and aunt there a day, then to Hawaii for a few days, and then to Wake Island and Japan, the Imperial Hotel in Japan. I think it was 29 hours flying from Hawaii to Japan with a one stop at Wake Island. I think I spent around 14 hours on a plane.
Is this proper?
Yes, this is the thing that I can relate to and when they changed from propeller planes to jet planes. When I went to Vietnam, all of the planes were propeller.
Yeah.
When I left Vietnam, everything had changed to jet planes in that 2 year period from 59 to 61. Uh-huh. I might mention that Dr. Nofsinger had written me about the possibility of going with a load of cattle on the Heifer Project to Vietnam. That would have delayed me 2 or 3 months, but I couldn't leave early enough to go on that, so they weren't able to work me into that. But if they'd done that, they would have put me on a ship taking care of these cattle for a good many weeks as they traveled across the Pacific, and eventually, I'm not sure where they were going to end up. But I remember that.
Was it Bob Yates who worked in the Heifer Project?
Well, now, he was in the original group in Vietnam. He was ahead of me, so I don't know. He may have gone over that way. It would have been a 2 to 3 month trip to get to Vietnam if I had gone that way.
Yeah.
So I got to Vietnam, I don't know, around the 15th of June, I think. Bob Kerstead and I arrived at the same time, and I can't remember Dick Kerstead. I can't remember where I met Dick right now, whether we met. We were in Hong Kong together because Dick had his passport in his pocket, and a lady next to him said, you know, the covers for those sell for X amount of money. I don't know what she said, $500 or $1,000 here. And Dick didn't say much. He turned a little red, but after the lady left, he took his passport out of his pocket and put it away.
Yeah. Someplace a little less conspicuous.
Yeah, but I remember that. That was sort of our introduction to Southeast Asia.
Was when you were getting to Hong Kong?
Yeah, that we were in Hong Kong.
You were in already?
On the way. And I bought a suit in Hong Kong for $29, and you know, went there, measured for it, went back the next day and got it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a Dacron suit, but that's the only suit that I had in Vietnam, and I kept that and wore that suit a good many years after I came back and I was in graduate school.
Yeah, I got a Hong Kong tailored suit too.
Didn't amount to that much, but I know everybody talked about how you can get a cheap form-fitted suit in Hong Kong, and I remember doing that, but it was a nice lightweight suit, but
yeah.
I'm not sure that it would be any fit any better perhaps than one you'd buy off the shelf today. But
yeah, but there's that snob.
That's
feel.
Right.
Yeah. Let me pause for a second here. Okay, well, yeah, I took that off now, and so we're back rolling again. Sorry for the interruption, but just as a brief
a brief stop that didn't have anything to do with your story, because you were mentioning Hong Kong and, you know, getting your suit, and I just had to mention, you know, about that other trip that's coming up.
Well, Dick and I then, I don't know whether, I think we may have met in Tokyo. I also bought a cheap little camera in Tokyo, and I had it for 20 years. But anyway, we went on to Vietnam, arrived at the Tansanet airport, and of course the IBS headquarters was near there.
Yeah.
The first thing we had to do after we were there.
Brand new.
The headquarters?
Yeah. Or fairly new, anyway.
I guess the building wasn't too old. It was a nice place. After we were there 2 or 3 days, let's see, Brock had finished up his tours, so at that time, I believe that Jerry Thurston and Ray Borton were handling things. And after being in Saigon 2 or 3 days, they took us to Ban My Thuot by using the highway that was close to Cambodia. Now, that was one of the last times that highway was used when I was there. I think that was closed a few months after that by the Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
That road was not used. You had to go up to Dalat and across to Ban My Thuot. But anyway...
And this is in 59.
This was in June of 59.
So it would have been closed before the end of the year.
I think
By 60, it was already off limits.
But that's the Ban My Thuot, of course, is where the first IBS team was.
That's right. Yeah.
And there were still a few, Clyde Eastman and Don Luce, Burr Frucci, Harvey Nice, I guess, were up there, Paul Sutton at that time. No, Paul, I believe, was down on the coast then. And then we went, seems to me like that we went down to Phan Rang or either up to Dalat. And that's where we had our language training with Chi. And my language training then consisted of about an intense week with Chi. Dick and I worked with him, and that was it for our language training.
That's all.
So I just learned enough Vietnamese, you know, to order food for a meal or to buy something and make change. So I never really learned enough Vietnamese to where I could hold a conversation in Vietnamese with the Vietnamese, or that I could write in Vietnamese that well. I had a very minimal vocabulary. But after we finished that, then I was assigned to the Hung Lok Station.
when you say that you couldn't carry on a conversation, but you had to work with people.
Well, we had interpreters with us.
Oh,
we had an interpreter assigned to each location.
Okay.
And that's how we carried on our business with the...
Okay.
When I was assigned to the Hung Lok Station, then the interpreter would go with us when we talked to the man that was managing the crops station, which was a couple of miles away from the livestock station.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Took, who managed the livestock station, could speak English. I can't remember the young man that was the manager of the crop station, but he could not speak English very well. We had difficulty understanding each other.
So, to some extent, you said what you did at both Hung Lok and, was it Bao Lok?
Bao Lok, Blau.
Blau, right. In parentheses there. But you were growing crops and testing varieties. For what kinds of crops?
At Hung Lok, we worked, the first crop I planted was peanut, which is rather ironic because was until recently the number one crop in Georgia, because I don't work with peanut diseases, but I thought that was rather interesting. And corn, they had just cleared the Hung Lok crop station from the jungle. They still had the long rows of the trees that had been bulldozed up that hadn't been burned yet when we got there. And our job was to plant crops into that land. And we planted corn, we planted peanuts. They were also planting sweet potatoes and other vegetables. I worked with beans. I had a large number of bean and cowpea varieties, that, especially cowpeas, that we grew, and to see, to get notes on how they grew. And we harvested the seed, made that available to local growers. The main object of that station was to grow seed and make it available to local growers who were refugees that had come from the north after the country was divided. There were many villages established in the Hunlock area that were just villages of refugees, because it was rather interesting to me. We would drive by a small village and you'd say, you know, there are a good many dozen people live out there, and we'd find out that there were several hundred, maybe thousands, in a relatively small area, because each one of them had an acre or two or three. But the government had deliberately settled a lot of the refugees from the north in the Hunlock area and surrounding counties, and we were to grow and provide seed for some of those villages. That was our primary responsibility to begin with.
What was the government strategy?
So that there would be a source of seed for these farmers. See, they'd established these villages, but they didn't have seeds to give them to plant crops.
Okay. That's a question that that's one question I should have asked. I was asking another one, though. What was the government strategy in terms of settling the people in that particular part of the country?
I guess they thought that it would make good farming area. It was formal jungle, but it could make good farming area. So they went into some of these areas, cleared huge areas, and made the land available to these refugees, as I understand it. I don't know how the government interacted on that, but we knew these were refugees' villages from the north, and most of our interpreters were, in fact, North Vietnamese that had come south. They were Catholic. Most of them that came south, of course, were Catholics who refused to live under the communists.
Yeah.
But she was, and Thuy was at Hung Lock, and I think Tuan, I think most of them were North Vietnamese.
But Catholic rather than Buddhist, and at least the major
affiliation. Well, one of them said that, you know, we're Catholic, but really most Vietnamese worship their ancestors, which would be, what, Taoism? I've forgotten what it's called, but that's, I believe that's one of the religions they had.
Of course, for a Roman Catholic Church, it would be heresy.
Yeah, but I mean, they had that all mixed in. I think that was not that uncommon.
Right, right, yeah, so I always tell my students to take that with a big grain of salt. Okay. Yeah, so this is basically all of you together in the one place except Sutton, who was...
No, there were several stations established at that time.
All right.
See, they were at Bamley Tuit, and they were spreading people out into these other stations, as this document I showed you here a while ago discussed establishing people at the other stations. Paul Sutton...
Okay, you're part of the beginning of that document. This is not a later thing. Okay.
No, that's right. This beginning. Harvey Neese was the first IBSer at Hunlock. And Dick and... Now, let's see. I was the second one. And then Jerry Thurston was there. And Dick was assigned...
Dick?
Kirsted, that came over with me. I think he was assigned to bind me to it. And Paul Sutton was at... Fon Rong at the dry, hot station, cattle station there. And Ray Borton was up at the lot at the vegetable station in the mountains. It's somewhat like Baguio.
He's got the plum spot.
Yes. Within a month after I came, Bob Plummer and Verl Lanier came, and Verl went down to the Mekong Delta at the rice station.
Verl Lanier?
Yes, and I think Bob went to Bound Me to It. Later, Bob came to Hung Lock. We served there together some. Jim Kelly served at a livestock station about halfway between the Trong and Bound Me to It. So we had people scattered. Bob Flaska was up at the Bow Lock station there, which was a part of the Agricultural Junior College. So we were scattered around, I guess, at a half a dozen places. MDROC, that was the name of the one where Jim Kelly was at the livestock session. It had a beautiful area of natural grassland across central Vietnam there where they were growing a lot of cattle. That's where the MDROC station was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, Kelly wrote me a nice long letter because he couldn't get to the mainland, I couldn't get out to the big island. So, and he did talk a little bit about that stuff.
So this was at the time, I'd forgotten it till I looked at that newsletter, where they were expanding, I believe, as they said, from 12 up to about 20. I think they decided that the maximum size of the team would be 20 at that time, whereas the first team from 57 to 59 was 8, 10, 12 people.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, they'd just gotten the contract with AID to do the agricultural work. And that's how they were doing that and how it was expanding. So in fact, IVS was under an AID representative. I'm sure Brock discussed that with you in detail.
Going. And all right, I guess where were we now?
Well, I was starting to say that Harvey Neese and I then were the first two at the Hung Lock station.
Oh,
I
yes.
was in
okay.
charge of working at the crops part of the station, and Harvey was working with the livestock.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I was doing then, in planting these crops and evaluating cowpeas and beans, and he was working with Mr. Took on the livestock program.
Okay, I'm trying to... Harvey Neese.
He's at the University of Idaho right now.
Oh, yeah, up in Troy. Troy, Idaho. Yeah, we eventually got something from him.
Yes, Harvey called me a few years ago about any pamphlets we might have available that would be the sort of extension pamphlets that have been used 40 years ago, because he had some work he was doing with developing countries on providing some agricultural extension production information, just basic technology of producing crops. I mean, what
uh-huh.
he wanted was a sort of extension bulletin that was put out years ago, that's not put out much today.
Really?
Uh-huh. And that's how I knew he was going. Anyway, that covers pretty much what we did at Hung Lock. And I think I was at Hung Lock something like 13 months, and then they transferred me to the Blau Agricultural College, a junior college in the town of Bao Lock. And so I was housed there at the station with Bob Knernshield, a horticulturalist, and Dick Cagle, who was no longer with IVS but was teaching agricultural engineering there at the college.
Mm-hmm.
And my job again was somewhat the same thing. Now, one thing I did at Blau was, because they didn't have a method of preserving agricultural feed during the dry season, I showed them how to make silage, and we dug a small trench silo and put Napier grass silage in it, backed it down and covered it. And then they took that silage out while I was still there, and it was good quality silage,
uh-huh.
and fed it to their water buffalo and the cows they had during the dry season. I also found some old files when the French were there. They had had an experiment station there, and they had some publications that I got, I guess, in the library of the college. But anyway, I got a lot of seeds. I did a lot of variety trials there in Blau, which is a much higher elevation than Hung Lock was,
uh-huh.
on wheats and sorghums and many different other crops, and took notes on that. That's part of what I did there. Bob Knernshield was working at the small horticultural station there in the horticulture crops. So I was not involved with that. One of the things all of us did, of course, was teach English to because some of the young people wanted to learn English in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
I remember doing that. But I was only at Blau about 9 months.
Well, why was it that you had to be switched from Blau to Balak and teach at Blau?
I think I didn't teach.
Get involved at the school.
I think the philosophy then was that people might begin to get disenchanted or dissatisfied or stagnant if they spent the full 2 years in one place. So I think the policy was to rotate people.
Oh.
Again, Brock probably talked to you about that. But most of us, to my knowledge, they did not leave anyone at one place for 2 years.
Well,
everyone was rotated.
Yeah, so it wasn't that your job as a job wound down at Hung Lot.
Someone replaced me at Hung Lot.
Okay, so you were replaced. So it wasn't that the job itself was petering out, and you
it
worked your way out.
It may have been changed in scope, since my primary responsibility was to help them get crops planted and get some information on how field crops might grow there in that area. And then with the basic information they had, and we put this into our annual reports,
right.
Then they may have decided to go a different way the second and third year.
Okay. Who was that that replaced you? Do you remember?
While I was at Hung Lot, Clyde Eastman was transferred in. I was trying to think. They may have gotten someone new may have come in.
Mm-hmm.
While I was in Vietnam, Kurt Dimmitt came in, and I think he went to Phan Rang. Mike Chilton came in, and he went to Delott, replaced Ray Borton when he left. Bob Plummer was at Hung Lot before I left. Dave Nuttall was at Hung Lot before I left. They were getting quite a few. We had four or five at Hung Lot
yeah.
the time I left, and they may have decided they didn't need that many.
Uh-huh.
But when I went up, Bob Falaska left Blau, and I think I took his place.
You mean his 2 years was finished?
His tour was finished.
So you took over from the rugby
merchant. Yeah, that's right. Clyde Eastman, Bob Falaska, Jim, Paul Sutton,
uh-huh.
and I think Jerry Thurston, Ray Borton. They had come a few months apart, but some of them extended. I think Jerry and Ray extended their time. They all left about the same time.
Uh-huh.
So those different people were put into those areas. Dick Peters came a few months after I did, and he went to Phan Rang.
Uh-huh.
And we also had, this has been mentioned before, Coles Clevenger came when Dick did. And he...
Coles Clevenger?
He was the only one, to my knowledge, that was asked to leave.
I heard about someone who was asked to leave, but who... they couldn't remember his name.
That's Coles Clevenger, C-O-W-L-E-S, from
yeah.
Illinois.
Yeah.
And I think he was later killed in an automobile accident a few years after
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. They also said that
he
was no longer alive.
But he was dissatisfied with what he was doing, and there was a difference of opinion.
C-O-W-L-E-S.
Yes, when he left, on certain people had feelings that he was not adjusting and doing what he should. Other people didn't think it was severe enough that he should have been asked to leave. But somewhere between 3 and 6 months, he was gone, and the rest of us found out in a roundabout way that he was asked to leave.
Think he was bitter about that?
No one knows. I don't think anyone had contact with him after he left. My impression was, even though he was dissatisfied with many things, he wasn't dissatisfied to the point that he wanted to leave. But I'm not sure that it was mutual.
So it was more the organization deciding that
he was not fitting in.
Yeah.
He's the only person that I know of that was asked to leave while I was there. But he was an agricultural graduate from the University of Illinois. And he and Dick Peters came at the same time, as I recall. Don Smith came later, and he worked at Farm Ron. Floyd Burrow, I mentioned to you. I'm not sure where Floyd worked. He may have worked at Bonnie Tuitt. But those were people that came after I did that I knew about at the different stations. We had semi-annual or annual meetings of the group that we would get together. We had an annual meeting at the lot in late November, early December of 59. And then after that, Jerry Thurston, Paul Sutton, and I, like we drove, were allowed to use a Jeep and drive all the way up to the, what was it, the 17th parallel? I was trying to think of the name of that town that was there. Bentree, was that the...
Well, there was a Quantree.
Quantree. We were able to drive within a few miles of the border and see the flag. We couldn't go right up the border, but we could see the flag where the border was from the hilltop. I remember doing that. That was rather impressive, knowing we were looking over into a communist country. But we were able to visit Marble Mountain, and I remember getting a few sibling souvenirs there. And that was at, I can't remember the name of that town now. That was became well known later on, Benang, during the war. And of course, on up the way, the old city, we saw the old imperial capital. And that was rather impressive. And we spent Christmas of 1959 at that, staying with some army officers. You know, at that time, we did not have active American troop involvement, but we had the American Army officers that were stationed there to help give advice to the
Vietnamese.
I was trying to think, MAG, Military Advisory Assistant Group. Also, when I was at Hung Lock, we drove down to MAG at Benoit one evening to watch a movie. And a few weeks after that, the Viet Cong set up a machine gun, poked it in the window of that room when they were watching a movie, and opened fire. And they happened to have it leaning on the edge of the windowsill to where it was pointed up. If it had been pointing straight into the room, they'd probably killed all the officers the way it was. I think we near killed one and injured a couple. But then we were, of course, advised then that we were not to be driving around at night. They were a little more liberal when we first got there, but within a matter of months, we were not allowed to leave our compound at night.
Wow, so even a matter of months when you got there in 59? Or are you talking about a matter of months from the time you get to Bao Lac?
No, no, at Hung Lac. This was when I was at Hung Lac.
Okay, I'm sorry.
All
right.
So, I think, as I recall, that Brock had to chastise us for that because we really weren't supposed to have been driving out at night then. But there was some misunderstanding in our group, or else some ignoring.
Selective perception.
Becoming, and there was such concern that we actually had guards at the entrance to our experiment station at night.
Oh, really?
A few months after we were there. So we weren't allowed to leave at all at night. And I remember we had a driver of our TD-9 Caterpillar there at the station that was called into the military. And he was with a truck that was ambushed, and he was killed about 20 or 30 miles from the station.
What truck is this?
He was with the Vietnamese military. He was drafted into the Army. He was the driver of our Caterpillar. He was drafted into the Army.
And then
we heard that he was ambushed on this road between Long Con and, I can't think of the name of the little town on there. The coast, but it was on a road that we had been on a few months before that. So even
this
we
is
were,
also when you were at Hung Lock.
We were oblivious of the fact that there was fighting going on, but in fact there were cells of communists around us,
uh-huh.
fighting going on, that it became more apparent to us the longer we were there. And I remember when Dave Nuttall came and said, you know, we need to have screens on these windows. They could toss a hand grenade right in here. Well, I remember laying awake at night and thinking about the possibility of somebody walking up and throwing a hand grenade in the window, something I hadn't even thought about before that. So we were there before the open hostilities, but there were hostilities while we were there.
But Nuttall was the one who pointed that out to you.
Yes. When he came to Hung Lock, he mentioned that. So we got screens on the windows so somebody wouldn't toss a hand grenade in.
Now, do you think that there was seriously a possibility of that, or do you think that...
Well, as I mentioned, they had the guards at the station uh-huh. entrance there at night. Of course, that would keep the Viet Cong from driving in the entrance. That wouldn't keep them from walking in
the back door.
I might mention here that when it came time for me to leave Bao Lac to come back to the United States, a taxi, which was just a small bus that went back and forth on the roads from Bao Lac down to Saigon, was ambushed on the road to Saigon.
Uh-huh.
And they closed that road for a period of time, so my departure from Blau to Saigon was delayed a few days. And we drove down that road and right past that area where that taxi was ambushed. That was one of the most nervous periods of time I had when I was there, was that last ride on that taxi to Saigon, thinking about what had happened there and realizing how things had changed.
Uh-huh.
country. Now, as I read the books, such as Ugly American and some others about Southeast Asia,
uh-huh.
I realized that before the country was separated in 1954, there had been ambushes on that highway going up into the mountains from Saigon during that period of time. But there were no problems at all when I was there until yeah. right before I left.
Uh-huh. Well, I think it's... I was asking about Nuttall's suggestion, because, you know, like you say, a guard at the front gate doesn't mean that they can't come in any old place that they want. But we talked a while ago before the tape was on about David Nuttall himself,
mm-hmm.
and you said that he always had a kind of interest in, you know, some of the military things that were going on, and I confirmed that he in fact had written that, even in his mm-hmm. survey that he sent in, and sent a letter saying how he had gotten the only way I can think of it is Medal of Honor sort of things from the CIA for his contributions. Those were post-IVS. They were not yes. during IVS. I think he made that pretty clear. But did you already see something when he was there that and you knew him when he was there, that showed that he was really interested in that gung-ho part of the war effort? Or?
I had no idea that he had any interest in that area. Of course, he had been in ROTC at Kansas State, I think.
Well,
you know, it was required.
Yeah, but everyone sure. would have been. Yeah.
But no, and of course, I wasn't looking for anything like that. Had no interest in
yeah.
that area. Wouldn't even have thought about it. I think it was safe to say that most of us came there, certainly myself, were pretty naive about the political aspects of what was going on in South Vietnam at that time. Of course, we discussed it after we got there and we became aware of it.
Right.
But we knew the country had been divided. I mean, we just assumed that had been settled. You know, the communists were in the north and the free peoples were in the south, and we didn't realize that, of course, it was a goal of Ho Chi Minh to take over the entire country, which they eventually did.
Yeah, but that's neat that you assumed it was settled.
Yeah, I went there to do agricultural work. I had no interest in the politics. Had no mm-hmm. idea that there was even a political problem.
Yeah,
and yeah. perhaps that was naive on my part. On the other hand, in the United States at that time, there was very little publicity or interest about what was going on in Southeast Asia in 1959.
Yeah. 59.
The Korean War had been over a few years,
uh-huh.
and there was just no a lot of talk about, and of course, usually college students don't pay that much attention to national, international politics anyway, but I was interested in the agricultural aspect. I had no idea I would run into some of the political aspects, so it was very educational for me.
I can remember it just as a kid around that age, but I'm younger than you. Let's see, 59.
I think that the time when the war, well, the American involvement expanded under President Johnson in 63 and 64. I think 64 is when they had the very first big influx of American troops. So it wasn't but a few years.
65, actually.
But there was a lot of change in philosophy from 59 to 63 or 4.
No, it's just I can remember something, reading a newspaper announcement about an engagement in Vietnam where, you know, a bunch of communists were caught in a crossfire and stuff like that. And I'm saying, what's all that about? But so it would have been making it as tiny stories inside of newspapers in the United States, not the big stories. And I only remember reading it because I was at not a relative's house, but people that I called aunt and uncle, even though they weren't. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing to do, so I was reading everything in the newspaper that Sunday.
Well, I think part of the reason that Dr. Nofsinger had us write letters home, and IVS reproduced those letters and sent them to people on our mailing list, was to help publicize what IVS was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that almost nobody knew much about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I even sent an article about back to the College of Agricultural Students, which I had worked on for, I think, a one-hour course in journalism. And I think they published a short article about the work I was doing at that time. But
did you ever get it?
I don't know whether I have a copy of it or not, but I think anything like that was considered pretty newsworthy then, because there were so few Americans in that part of the world, and Americans in general knew so little about it, in contrast to the late 60s and the 70s, when, of course, it was on the evening news almost every night.
Yeah, very much so. Well, and of course, for your old campus newspaper, it'd be great to get that kind of story. They'd really want that.
Yeah, that was the agricultural student. It wasn't for the campus newspaper. It was just for the College of Agriculture.
Oh, it was just within the college.
Publication.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. But there were several volunteers from Kansas at that time. So you asked about my interest. I'm not sure what the others' interests were, but Dave Nuttall, and I mentioned later Larry Lavrence, came, and it seems to me like there were one or two others. So there were several volunteers from Kansas in a 2 or 3 year period there.
Yeah, well, you're the first Kansas. Let me just pause.
Jerry Thurston.
Yeah. And Jerry Thurston,
yes,
yeah.
There's another one.
Yeah. Well, I'll probably get through some additional questions that I might have too, because I had read over your form as well, and some general questions too. Let me pause this while I look over. One thing that I turned this back on now. One thing that we did mention, we've already mentioned, was that the IBS activities were, of course, under contract with AID.
Mm-hmm.
And that Brock was going to have to meet with AID officials and discuss assignments and activities and such. What about you yourself when you were down in the field and the actual assignment? What was your relationship to AID?
They would come by every few months and visit around and say, yeah, you fellows are doing a fine job, and they'd get back into their cars and go on. So we
that doesn't sound very intensive to me.
No, we didn't have a close contact with them,
uh-huh.
But the administrators within IVS, the chief of party and assistant chief of party, had more contact. And of course, they were in Saigon, where it was much easier to have day-by-day contact. when I was in Saigon, the first few days after we got there, because we had to go to the embassy and have a lecture, I remember this one person saying they just sent home somebody that had amoeba of the brain, so we really did have to be careful about what we ate and drank. And then we went to the AID headquarters. It was not AID then, it was USOM.
Yeah.
United States Operations Mission. And went through and met the different people in the different areas. They had a person in charge of each different area. They had a person in charge of rice. And so when Burl Lanier worked a little more closely with that individual, I think when he was down in the Delta. And they'd have a person in charge of livestock. I remember meeting that individual, and I think Harvey Neese worked more closely with him. Dr. Bond, I think was his name, the former veterinarian from Alabama. And so they had people in the different areas, but I never worked that closely. Well, Bob Falaska, when he was helping to get cacao, cocoa established, he worked with Lewandowski, who was a refugee from Russia sometime after the revolution and was a tropical rubber specialist. So they worked together rather closely trying to get the tribes people to plant cacao as a source of income, because it would grow originally in the shade of jungle trees until it got established. So it just so happened that I didn't have that close a contact with any of the USOM people and the work I was doing. But I met them.
Yeah, it sounds almost like serendipity that, that you might or might not have someone to work with rather than a concerted, well-coordinated program from AID standpoint.
Well, yes, but IVS wanted it that way. Some of the IVSers were concerned that we might become lackeys for USOM, and of course we didn't want to be that way. And in general, I think that the person from USOM assigned to be the liaison officer with IVS left it as rather a loose arrangement. But now about the time I left, the person that took over that position, there was some concern that he might try to micromanage a little more than the previous person did.
You mean the AID person?
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember the name? That might stretch it.
No. And I was trying to think of the man that was in charge most of the time I was there, and I can't think of his name. Brock probably gave me the names because he worked with him. It so happens the man that took over about the time I left, in fact, had a B.S. degree in plant pathology from Fort Collins. So that was rather interesting, but I can't think of his name right now.
Okay. Well, even without the names, the fact that you were kind of left free.
I think we had a good relationship at that time. Now, it's possible in later years it wasn't as good. And of course, you have that information from other individuals.
Right.
But at no time did I feel like that we were having pressure on our day-to-day activities. Certainly, we were told what general area we were supposed to be working in. I mean, I didn't have the freedom to go off, spend all my time working livestock, because I knew I was assigned to the crops area, and Harvey was assigned to livestock.
Right.
And when I was up at Glau, I had a general idea of what I was supposed to have been doing. It was still within the crops area. But as far as what I decided to do, I had the freedom to visit with the college officials and at the college and my agricultural counterparts and get some idea of what they thought was needed and where there were some gaps and what we could do. And that's what we tried to do. I didn't have my own agenda. Now, some of the IVSers may have had more than I, but my feeling was that, you know, I'm here to do what will be of best use to the farmers and agriculture in the country, and so I'm going to try to do what they need within my area of interest, which was crops. That's why I was hired to work on crops, my background with crops and so on.
No, this is important. That observation's important. And just I'll pause for my own thought. I just gave my comments. Now it's back to you. But go on.
We were talking about the different countries. The joke was at that time when I visited Laos was that if the communists took over Laos, it would set them back 40 years.
So because it was so poor?
That was generally considered to be just about the poorest country in the world at that time, because it didn't have the natural resources. Vietnam was considered to be a country with good natural resources, and I will have to say, while I was there, I saw very little hunger. I was well impressed with the way people ate, with the way they were growing, able to grow the crops, and of course the Mekong Delta at one time had been the rice bowl of Asia, as it is becoming again to this day. So Vietnam had a lot of potential, but in Laos was very poor, and Cambodia was in between. And during my vacation in, as I said, December of 59, it was actually February 1960 when Gerald Thurston, Paul Sutton, and I took our annual vacation, and we went over to Phnom Penh and to Bangkok, flew from Bangkok on a military plane up to Vientiane, and then from Vientiane up to Zinh Quang, traveled by a jeep up to farther into Laos. So I got to see, saw Angkor Wat, I got to see Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, and there was really no comparison between Laos and Vietnam as far as natural resources are concerned. But I was impressed with the volunteers I met in all three countries.
Yeah. But as far as security, Laos was, 59-60 was a pretty hot place. Was that your impression?
There was not that much concern in February of 1960, in my estimation.
Okay.
It may have increased pretty rapidly after that.
I was thinking, because that was Laos was one of the first things that Kennedy had to deal with.
Okay. There was a general feeling that the PATH at Laos were rather incompetent, I think, while I was there also.
I think that feeling persisted.
But there was still a king in Laos at that time. The government itself was considered to be rather, almost marginally. It was just a very poor country with very...